Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Hello and welcome to the new year. It is now 2014, and to this Peak Prosperity podcast, I am your host, Chris Martinson. Today we're going to focus on the economy and financial markets, and especially the degree to which they have become heavily distorted by the most exceptional monetary experiment in all of history. I'm talking about QE, of course. And to help us understand where we are economically and financially and where we might be headed, I am really pleased to welcome Brian Preddy as today's guest. Brian is the managing editor of ContraryInvestor.com, which looks at markets from the perspective of the institutional buy-side money manager. And I've been a reader of Contrary Investor for many years and found a kindred voice there that used data and logic and history as the means of examining current market events. Contrary Investor is written, edited, and published by a very small group of real-world institutional buy-side portfolio managers and analysts with at least 20 years of individual street experience. And I've invited Brian onto the program to get a better look inside the minds of those who are managing big money, as well as to discuss a few reports he's written recently that really caught my attention for the cautionary tone they're sounding. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Chris, very much appreciate the opportunity, and my very best to all of your listeners for, and I mean this in order of importance, health, happiness, and prosperity for the new year ahead.
Fantastic. I love that ordering. Let's begin at the top then with things that might impact those three things. The effects of QE and related efforts by Japan, Europe, the effects of those on our markets and their structure, that's one of the things I'm most concerned with these days. You've written that things are well and truly distorted this time, and you use the term the fingerprint character differences that we're seeing in the current economic and financial market cycles, the so-called recovery we're in, relative to historical experience. Let's begin with house prices, all in the news because they are rocketing up, particularly in some communities, especially those hardest hit, by whole double-digit percentages, by the same amounts that we used to see in what we called a housing bubble. But this time, I guess it's healthy. Is it?
Chris, I'll tell you, maybe luckily or unluckily for myself, I almost live at ground zero. I'm here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah.
So we are seeing things, at least in the Bay Area proper, Chris, that we haven't seen for a long, long time. Some of the Case-Shiller numbers were not only double-digit, Chris, but I think they were in the 20s. You know, it was a 20,
yeah,
23,
yeah, yeah.
Something like that, kind of a number year over year. And here, clearly, not only are we seeing kind of international money coming into this area more and more, but we've got the wild tech boom going on, you know, the Twitters and the Zingas and all these other wonderful things coming public. So there's a lot of capital, and I've been almost convinced, Chris, that one of the things we're seeing this cycle that's a little bit different is we're seeing the geographic concentration of wealth. You know, if you look at places like London, if you look at places like New York, the San Francisco Bay Area, you would think that the economy is just absolutely, the broader economy, is absolutely on fire. But it's really these geographic areas, Chris, that seem to be so strong. And maybe crazily enough, because that geographic concentration of wealth creates multiplier effects in those areas, it draws even more capital in. You know, so you get even an accelerated, if you will, multiplication of wealth. And those economies, those microeconomies, look really good. But when we look at some of the really big numbers, Chris, and I think, you know, in this day and age, whether it's through our handheld mobiles or our laptops or whatever it is, we get a lot of news in soundbite form, kind of one-liners, you know, housing this month, you know, up 9% year over year, you know, the prices are up this, blah, blah, blah. And so it sounds great. But when we start to dig under the headlines and look at what have been some of the tried and true metrics, especially of the housing industry over time, it paints a much different picture, Chris. I mean, never, you know, have I heard, let's call it over the last 2 to 3 years, I've never heard a mainstream, presenter of facts say something like, well, housing starts have just recovered to a five-decade low. But that's where we are right now when we look at the real numbers.
Yep.
And the same thing is happening with starts, you know, as you would imagine. Most of the starts are in multifamily. But it's very, very subdued activity. And again, it's never really presented that way, you know, in the mainstream press. Not that that's right or wrong. Mortgage applications, they hit a it's a five-year low a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, in one sense, Chris, we've got these prices going straight up, but we don't have the underlying metrics that in past cycles would have told us that the housing market is very healthy. And a healthy housing market includes meaningful increases in starts, meaningful increases in new home sales, meaningful increases in new mortgage purchase apps, and also a meaningful contribution of residential real estate construction to GDP. We're also not seeing that at all. In fact, we're very near the lows, you know, of prior cycles. Chris, I'll tell you, it's just my own interpretation of life, but what I think we've got going on here in housing is we've got an investment cycle, not an economically driven housing cycle, from the standpoint that, you know, really never before have 40 to 50% of all real estate transactions, residential real estate transactions, been for cash. We've never seen that, you know, in prior cycles. Absolutely not. You know, what is driving that? Well, in one sense, Chris, I, and not, this is not a point of blame, but more a look at the unintended consequences of what the actions of QE are. When you lower these interest rates and you take away a safe rate of return in alternative assets such as, I mean, it could have been 5 years ago, you could have got 5% in a CD, a treasury bond, even a money market fund. Well, for a lot of those people who had been savers and investors in safe assets, they don't have a rate of return anymore. What do? They take their $300,000, $400,000 nest egg out of the bank and they turn around and buy a rental property where they can theoretically get a 6%, 7% cash-on-cash rate of return, and all of a sudden that becomes their rate of return. So I think we're clearly seeing this, Chris, where assets are being lifted out of alternative investments, whether it's, you know, again, treasuries or CDs or bank accounts, and being used to buy residential real estate. Of course, you know, the issue becomes one of risk, meaning, you know, a treasury bond never really needs a replacement roof, and the water heater doesn't break, and there's no vacancies. So we're increasing risk in these asset class choices, yeah, investment choices, but it's a forced choice because there is no other rate of return. And for people who need that to live, you know, that's why I think we're seeing the big cash transaction levels that we've never really seen before. Second part of the equation, foreign money is absolutely on the move. I mean, Chris, we're talking on the first business day of the new year. And again, one of the things that's in the news this morning being talked about is there going to be some type of an IMF-driven 10% deposit tax in the Euro banking system? Well, this has been being talked about now for probably 2, 3, 4 months. The trial balloons go up in the air. The Euro banking crowd has also talked about potentially negative interest rates. So, you know, maybe a very simple question, Chris. If you're a Euro citizen and your net worth is caught up in Euros and or you have assets in the Euro banking system, what do? You get them out, you know, before something like this happens. And really maybe we can draw the parallels, too, with a Japan where we've seen monetary debasement and true currency debasement in very, you know, violent form over the last year since Abe's been elected. If you're a Japanese citizen and your net worth is caught up in yen, you've lost 20% of your global purchasing power. What do you do? Capital begins to move globally. And I think part of what we're seeing, well, there may be one last piece here, too, is the current leadership in China is cracking down on corruption. So, you know, as I know you know full well, moving capital out of China is illegal. There's only one way to get it out. You've got to have serious capital. So what is it doing? It's hiding in alternative assets globally. It's coming to what it perceives, for now, the perception of safety that may be the U.S. dollar. And if you're coming to the U.S. dollar, what do? Well, you can buy bonds, you can buy stocks, you can buy a business, you can buy real estate. And because safe rate of return has been basically taken away, real estate and perhaps stocks, too, are a repository for that foreign capital. And then, you know, maybe lastly, you know, more than not, that global capital being on the move is again, concentrating in some of these geographic areas that we're seeing. I mean, prices in the New Yorks, prices in the Londons, prices in the San Francisco Bay areas are just really off the charts here. So, you know, Chris, this is very much unlike prior cycles where we saw, and I know this sounds a little simplistic and Pollyannish, but we see younger families getting jobs, making a little bit more money, all of a sudden they can afford a home. They take on a mortgage purchase application. Maybe they buy your or my house, and the food chain moves up. That's not happening this time. So this is really an investment cycle as opposed to, you know, a true economically driven housing cycle. And I just asked myself, Chris, is the linchpin in all of this the if you will, dividing line of alternative rates of return, meaning interest rates. And as we saw rates tick up, really since May of last year, we saw things like mortgage purchase apps and refi apps just drop like a rock. So, you know, as we move forward, these big metrics that are, you know, the interest rates, that are treasury rates, very, very meaningful. And will they be the catalyst of change ultimately in the housing cycle as opposed to the economy being that catalyst? Again, we're just seeing something very different this time, Chris.
Well, Brian, excellent summary, and I want to see if I can summarize this because, you know, it was back in 2008 when I first finished the Crash Course proper, and it was probably early 2008 when I was putting together the chapter on what I called what was going to be the most likely outcome, which was printing, money printing. And one of the effects we know from money printing, this idea of seigniorage, that those closest to the money printing gain the most benefit. So a couple of the dynamics you've put in here, one, investors being driven into housing almost by, you know, the financial repression. They've been forced into housing because that's where attractive rates of return exist. We've heard about the big ones, the BlackRocks, et cetera, the big private equity firms that have moved in and bought houses by the thousands in certain key districts, but as well mom and pops who don't like the returns they're getting on other so-called safe assets. So they might have been driven in as well. So you have that one big dynamic driving housing in as well. I wonder if you've looked into the data deeply enough to answer this question. We know that the extremely wealthy whose money are flowing into, say, the London markets or the New York markets or even some of the foreign extremely wealthy people flowing into your neck of the woods in Northern California, specifically Silicon Valley. I'm wondering if the propensity to buy large trophy houses is driving up that average sales price to what extent it is that this money that's flowing preferentially to the 1%, to put a number on it, whether that's having an undue influence on the overall statistic of average home price we're seeing. That is there sort of a bimodal distribution in the data? Are we seeing that, you know, very what I will call average houses may be languishing compared to larger slash trophy houses for those who can afford them in certain key areas? Is this a place where averages are hiding something from us, or indeed are we seeing a very broad-based increase in prices, which paradoxically, maybe locking out those first-time buyers that you were just talking about?
You know, Chris, maybe there's a little bit of both going on here, and maybe if I can describe it this way, it will have changed over time. Meaning, you know, if we run this clock back to maybe 2009, 2010, a lot of the lower-priced homes, call it $150,000, $200,000, were really being bought up by, as you say, you know, the Blackstones, the Colony Capitals down in L.A., you know, et cetera. And those home prices really started to move up on a percentage basis. Mm-hmm. And again, it's very easy to get, you know, a large percentage moves off very small basis. But I know you and your listeners know this, Chris. Over the recent past, some of these big institutional players now, and this is really a matter of arbitrage more than not, are starting to issue fixed income securities against future rental payments. You know, so in one sense, and I saw some of the term structures on these things, Chris, just, you know, absolutely unbelievable from an arbitrage standpoint. They can issue some longer-dated bonds here with, you know, a buck and a half on the coupon, you know, 175, 2% on the coupon. And they could turn around and put that money to work mid-single digit, high single digit. So, I mean, in one sense, you know, heads I win, tails I win, too, you know, from the institutional side. But as time has kind of progressed, and I've seen some of this in our local areas, Chris, that some of the really big institutional investors now are starting to balk. Some of the folks I've known that have been lending the money or lending, you know, some institutions money to do this have told me that, you know, some of the activity has really started to slow down because the numbers now are not quite as attractive as they used to be at the lower end vis-a-vis, you know, cash flow rental, et cetera. But at the high end, Chris, and boy, I'll tell you, you know, San Francisco to Silicon Valley is, and it's, you know, again, my immediate area that I see is very, very different than what we see throughout the country. I mean, I grew up, you know, in San Francisco, in the San Francisco Bay Area. Chris, the prices we're seeing today are just off the charts, and it's almost become, you know, the trophy-ish type of deal. One of the things that has happened recently in San Francisco, and this is just a little microcosm more than not, is there's a little bit of a backlash starting to grow against the tech industry. In San Francisco, rents are protected, and you can evict protected renters under what's called the Ellis Act. And there have been many Ellis Act evictions over the last year or so. So this little outcry is starting to grow, a little bit of a groundswell, and that, you know, investors will come in, buy up these multi-unit places, kick out renters who've been protected at very low rents, and the rents are up 2, 3, 4, 5 times, you know, what these folks were paying. So, you know, Chris, I think that does distort some of this, too, because the prices of properties in these areas, and I mean this, and I know it sounds crazy probably for a lot of listeners in other parts of the country, $500 a square foot, are you kidding me? That could be a starting price. $800, wow. $1,000 a square foot for some of these places, it's not unheard of. It's common. And wow. That is not what we really see as we look across the breadth of what we call this asset class called residential real estate in the United States. But in these areas, such as, you know, the New Yorks, such as the San Francisco Bay areas, the price per square foot, if we could use that as hopefully a common metric across, you know, the landscape, is just so different than anything we see across mainstream or averages. It isn't funny. So perhaps, Chris, a number of years ago, it was really pressure on the low end coming up, price pressure, you know, on the upside at that low end from the institutions. But what I've seen locally is they've been backing off recently. But the heavy capital that has come into some of these areas, and again, some of the big tech money that's been realized over the recent past, especially in the San Francisco Bay Area, has really driven up the top end in a very big way. And Chris, it's a crazy thing to say because, you know, I grew up in an area where 30 years ago, you could have bought some of these houses for $100,000. Today they're going for $1.5 million, $1.7 million. I mean, the numbers are just staggering, you know, when you look across time.
Well, Brian, so just I ask this question all the time. I never get a good answer because I don't think one exists. How do people who have average salaries who are filling in the so-called blue-collar middle-class jobs, how do they survive out there?
Chris, there is no answer because I really don't know the answer to that question. What I see happening here is that, and especially in San Francisco, again, it's I hate to keep coming back to this one specific area, mm-hmm. but you've got a lot of young folks who want to live here. I can remember a few years ago, I have a client whose son was very high up in Salesforce. Salesforce was considering moving to Texas, and their employees basically told them, Chris, if you move to Texas, you're moving without us. We're staying here in San Francisco. Hmm. What ends up happening, Chris, is, you know, the Google campus is down in the southern part of the Bay Area. The Apple campus is down in the southern part of the Bay Area. But buses run daily from San Francisco down to Google, down to Apple. A lot of the young kids want to live in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Culturally, it's, you know, kind of a cool thing to do. So what we're seeing, Chris, is, you know, maybe $4,000 monthly rentals for two-bedroom apartments are being filled with four kids. You know, we're filled with three kids. And I hate to use the word kids. These are adults.
Yeah. Yep.
But very, very expensive to do this. But that's why, again, we're starting to see this little groundswell recently, Chris, of that, let's call it the service sector economy, who really can't afford to live in the city in which they work. So they get pushed out further and further and further. And, Chris, I've talked to a lot of children of clients, and they've told me that over the past 2 to 3 years, they're having a lot of trouble, you know, if you will, even being able to put in a practical bid on a home because they're bidding against all cash buyers, etc. I had a client a couple of weeks ago. His daughter was looking for a home. She had been outbid probably 5 times in all cash offers. He had to lend her the money to make an all cash offer and then come back and refi the home and put a mortgage on it later on. It was the only way she could get in. So it's really a tough deal for the younger folks, Chris, because they're being priced out by the quote unquote perceived necessity of investment money to move up the rate of return food chain. And that really, you know, to me, and I know this is kind of a social comment more than not, really disrupts the economic food chain, not the investment food chain, the economic food chain that necessarily needs to happen over time. We look at household formations in the United States, they're declining. We look at the home ownership rate, and it's declining. We don't see that in economic recoveries, Chris. We see quite the opposite. So is this, again, kind of the distortion of QE and what it's caused in terms of changed behavior and how it kind of negatively influences those at the lower economic strata? I think this is exactly what we're looking at.
You know, this is a very interesting topic, of course, right in the center of it, and I do want to make sure I have time to ask you the most important question for a lot of people who are writing into my site, which is, should I buy a home now? There have been people on the sidelines for a while and getting antsy, quite understandably. But what you're talking about here is the distortive effects of QE, this financial repression. If we drive interest rates down to zero on safe assets, of course, zero is an unacceptable return, so we have to go out and find it. And we find it in asset markets. And Ben Bernanke, I believe it was an op-ed in 2009 or 10 in the Wall Street Journal, he said this is exactly what they wanted to do. They wanted to see house prices move up, and they want to see equity prices move up. This is something I critiqued and faulted Greenspan for a lot, was confusing rising asset prices with rising wealth. It looks like wealth, tastes like wealth, feels like wealth, but it's not actually wealth. Wealth is the things that, of course, you've been writing about and talking about. It's about real investment in real property, plant, and equipment. It's about adding value somewhere in the chain. As we all know or should know, the so-called wealth that comes from housing prices rising or from equity prices rising is potentially chimerical. It could be there 1 minute and not there the next. So asset prices come and go. Real wealth is a durable substance. And so as we sort of widen our view up a little bit and we look at, of course, I think the lifeblood of our economy, QE or not, has always been looking at the bank loans and bank lending that's been happening, that lending is going to happen for all sorts of purposes, maybe for a home, maybe it's for new property, plant, and equipment. That's something that I think you've written about and I've noticed as well seems to be completely missing from this so-called recovery, is any meaningful recovery in the increase in bank loans and leases. What's the data telling you there?
Chris, again, and I know it sounds melodramatic, absolutely anomalistic in the current cycle relative to anything we've seen over the last five decades. And again, I know that sounds melodramatic. Mm-hmm. Right now, the loan-to-deposit ratio in the banking system is where it was in 1983. We haven't seen a level this low, you know, since that period of time. And we can remember back in 1983, Chris, and you know what banks do for a living. They do one of two things. You know, they take your deposit money and they either lend it out at a spread or they invest it in what they hope are, again, securities that will yield them more than they're paying out in their cost of funds. Well, back in 1983, they could have gotten what? 10%? 8%? 7%? 6%?
Yeah.
In very safe treasuries, let alone corporate bonds or whatever they might have been. So there was one huge incentive in the early 1980s to invest rather than to lend, so to speak. But as interest rates got lower and lower and lower over time, we saw a lot of banks really increase loan to deposits. And at one point in time, Chris, and this is really, late 1990s, early 2000s, the loan to deposit ratio in the United States was actually above 100%. What that really meant was banks had borrowed money, largely from the Federal Home Loan Banking System, and had lent out above and beyond, what their level of deposits was. That's how confident they were, you know, at that time in making corporate loans.
Mm-hmm.
Well, today, Chris, we just don't see it. And I think part of what's going on here, and I assume most folks are fully aware of this, starting in 2009, you know, what the Fed did is it told the banks that if the banks had excess capital, excess reserves, it would pay them a quarter point on that money. So in one sense, Chris, we created a closed loop cycle here. The Fed prints money. It buys or creates electronic digits, whatever you want to call it. It buys bonds back from the financial system, but largely the banks. The banks now have capital. They turn around and put that money right back with the Fed at a quarter point. Might as well earn, the rate of a two-year treasury or a three-year treasury, whatever it may be, and not take any risk at all. And so it never gets into the system itself. And, you know, part of what we're seeing, Chris, I think is the number of creditworthy borrowers has declined in this environment. But the second part of the equation is that, again, banks would rather use this capital to do something else as opposed to make loans with it. And at least until, let's call it May of last year, the Fed had basically guaranteed that they would keep their foot on the neck of the long end of the bond market. So all a bank had to do was raise deposits and turn around and buy 10-year treasuries, and as long as they stayed in control, they'd earn a spread and they never had to go to work or take any risk all day long. They would just, and again, Chris, I'm convinced, it was part and parcel of the Fed's modus operandi to recapitalize the banking system without the banks taking on additional credit risk, and that's been happening. But now all of a sudden, you know, we've got a little bit of a changed environment with the interest rate markets, and it's a little bit different for the banks, but we still don't see the type of credit creation that we've seen in the past. And maybe one last tangential issue, Chris. When we really look at this thing from a long, long-term perspective, and let's call it, three, four decades, what we've really lived through is, I used to ask this question all the time, largely to myself, for the last 12 years. Are we living in a business cycle or a credit cycle? A business cycle or a credit cycle? Which one is it? Well, from my view of the world, it had really been a credit cycle. I mean, what was the huge buildup in household mortgage debt, pre 2005, 2006? Well, that was a credit cycle. You know, what was Greenspan lowering interest rates to 1 and all these other wonderful things, and even Bernanke lowering rates? It was to incite a credit cycle again. That's the horse that brought us in this economy over the last 3-4 decades. Well, the tough part in this one, Chris, this cycle, is that the private sector has to delever. It's got too much leverage already, and it needs to contract that leverage either through debt pay down and or just halting the rate of credit acceleration. Well, somebody has got to be the borrower in a system heavily dependent on credit, and that borrower has been the U.S. federal government since really the end of 2008. Federal debt since the fourth quarter of 2008 has doubled, and it's really easy to do when the Fed pushes interest rates down to zero. Your cost of capital is basically nothing. I mean, we've got a 1-year treasury here at 1/10 of a basis, or 10 basis points. You can't even feel the interest costs when you take on that kind of leverage. So in one sense, Chris, the whole thing has been flipped on its head in this cycle, in that the borrower has become the government. And this isn't just the United States. Look what's going on in Japan. Look what's going on in the European community, the broader Asian community. It's the governments that have become the key provocateurs of the credit cycle, and it's the private sectors that are really trying to heal. But given that, you just don't get the type of economic acceleration that you get in normal economic cycles, because the governments are horribly inefficient allocators of capital. And if they're the ones borrowing the capital, not a great deal. That's why we're ending up with 2% GDP growth rates.
So this is a really fascinating topic. This is one that I've been focusing on for a while. So let's take long bond interest rates in 1980, from which they began a very long descent downwards in yield. And so that's a long bond bull market. And it was right around that same time that our country and much of the developed world departed from what we might call normal debt to GDP ratios and got on a cycle of borrowing at a much faster rate than even nominal GDP growth. And so that's the system we're addicted to. That's what I believe that Greenspan, that's what I think Bernanke, that's what I think Janet Yellen is going to be in charge of trying to get us back onto, is something that I think any grade school child could tell you can't do forever. Right. So we might title this podcast, Where Do We Go From Here? Because from 1980 to current, we basically ran interest rates as close to zero as you can. There's not a lot of room left to go unless you're willing to entertain negative interest rates. And the Fed is busily trying to get us back onto this idea of growing credit at roughly twice the rate of real GDP growth. And obviously that you can't do that with your credit card compared to income. You can't do that as a business. You probably can't do that as a state. I mean, you can't do it as a nation, but here we are. And so the question then becomes, we're starting 2014. We're now going to be in our fifth full year of QE. And by every measure, say GDP growth or employment rates, things like that, we might say it's not really working. Where does the Fed go from here?
Chris, sorry to make this a pandering comment. That is absolutely the question of the moment. And that's the key, as we kind of look into 2014 here. And again, I'll just throw this out as a question, Chris. Is the beginning of Fed tapering? So I'll tell you what, let's back up for 2 seconds. When we started QE3, year-over-year rates of change in payroll employment growth and year-over-year rates in change of GDP were not much better than we see today. Now, admittedly, we recently had a 4.1% GDP number, but I think and I know. 1.7 of that number was inventory accumulation. Look, if you're a business person, inventory accumulation is not a good thing. It's a bad thing. So you strip 1.7 off that, and then the final revision of the GDP number included an increase in both, it was personal consumption expenditures, but it was personal consumption expenditures for energy and health care. That's not for building new plant and equipment. So you strip those things out, Chris, and we're really still back down to about a 2%, kind of a GDP number here.
Mm-hmm.
So, in one sense, has the economy really done what the Fed wanted it to do when we started QE3? We want better payroll employment growth. Hey, now I get it. You got the unemployment rate down, but that's really because of the distortion of the labor force participation rate. Did you really spark GDP here, even though that last little headline number kind of looked nice? Again, if you only looked at the soundbite headline number, sure. Chris, I tell you, I think what's really going on here is the Fed knows it's reached its limits. And here's the deal. They, at the $85 billion a month, they were printing 30 to 35 cents of every dollar the U.S. government spends. I mean, when does the capital market wake up someday and go, hey, wait a minute, we're on an unsustainable path here, mm-hmm. you know? And the second part of the equation is that they were basically owning huge portions of the mortgage-backed securities markets and really the 10-year treasury. In one sense, Chris, these are really sacred to me, traffic lights. I know that's a Jim Grant characterization.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for the economy, in terms of pricing risk, I mean, what is the capital asset pricing model that, you know, Bill Sharp participated in Nobel Prizes for? It's all about the pricing of risk relative to that risk-free rate. And when you distort that darn risk-free rate, you're really distorting, you know, prices across the board. So I'm not trying to say that, you know, the Fed woke up one morning, Chris, and came to some incredible revelation that they're distorting the financial markets. But they know the level of distortion that they have created. And if they continue to do this, they know that this distortion is ultimately impacting the real economy. So I'll tell you, Chris, I think they're going to back away from this because they have to. They know they have to. Otherwise, the logical extension here is that within, let's call it 2 to 3 years, maybe 4 years, would the Fed own the entire treasury market? Well, yes, they would. They can't go there. They just can't without really, you know, kind of destroying the integrity, I use that word loosely these days, of that market. And then maybe lastly, Chris, really quick and tangential. When you look at some of the real data here, the one thing that we're absolutely missing in this cycle is we're missing investments. When we look at capital expenditures, and I don't care whether it's small businesses or large businesses, we're looking at a level of nominal dollar CapEx, Chris, that we saw in 1999. I mean, come on. This is what allows economies to grow over time. This is what allows economies to flourish, and that is investment that ultimately produces income somewhere down the line. When we're doing QE and companies are choosing to take their cash and not increase their businesses, not have it go into plant and equipment, but having it buy back their stock, and I understand why. The numbers arbitrage is as clear as a bell. I'd be doing the same thing, you know, borrowing it next to nothing and buying back my stock. But that does nothing for the long-term economic viability and growth potential of any economy, U.S. or otherwise. So are they getting to the point where they're realizing these things and saying, you know what, regardless of what the quote-unquote numbers look like ahead, you know, whether it be payroll or whether it be GDP, we got to knock this off. I think that's where we are.
Well, this is interesting, this idea that CapEx is really low, CapEx, capital expenditures by businesses, because they're really being treated to, as far as I can tell, a once in a not just a lifetime, but several lifetime low in corporate financing costs. So they've got really, really cheap money, as you mentioned. And that would be a great time to plow it back into property, plant, equipment. It's not just slightly anemic. I'm looking at a chart here that shows that, you know, in 2005, 6, 7, they were plowing in anywhere from, say, plus 7% to plus 20% year-over-year growth in CapEx. That's what sort of a boom period feels like. And 2013 is going to clock in at minus 1.5. Based on early reports, looks like 2014 might slip a further 5 from there. So those are percentage points. So CapEx just really isn't there. And the federal government is also not investing in a similar fashion. They've got, I believe, some of the lowest investment stances we've ever seen, or at least in several decades. I believe we have to go back to the early 90s. So we're not investing in property, plant, equipment, public or private. We have all this really, really cheap money. It's definitely flying into asset classes. We're all supposed to feel good that we see all this money flying into various asset classes. And, of course, one of the things the stock bulls like to say is that corporate profits are really high relative to GDP, all-time highs. And wages and benefits are really kind of plumbing some historical lows. Is that not a bullish setup?
Chris, you hit the numbers exactly on the head. I mean, right now, corporate profits as a percentage of GDP are resting at near all-time highs. It's close to about 11 to 12% of GDP.
Mm-hmm.
The crazy part is, Chris, and I know you probably know these numbers, you know, I went back and looked at these. In every single economic down cycle, and there are no exceptions to this, all the way back to the beginning of the GDP numbers in 1948, the lows were 5 to 6% of GDP, corporate profits 5 to 6% of GDP. So number one, Chris, based on historical averages and based on historical experience, we're as overextended now as we ever have been before, profits relative to GDP. And, you know, the quote-unquote headline bullishness of something like corporate profits, I understand. I get it. But again, as you said, these corporations have been treated to a once-in-a-lifetime drop in cost of debt capital. So number one, you know, even very, let's call them, marginal corporations have been able to live. And very healthy corporations, you know, any CFO who hasn't been borrowing to buy back stock in the last 3 years should have been fired 3 years ago, so to speak, because the arbitrage numbers are huge. And again, I know you know this. If we were to strip buybacks out of last year's S&P earnings per share numbers, we wouldn't have a hell of a lot of earnings growth. And, you know, Chris, again, I know this is tangential, but the one thing that's really caught my eye recently, and I think, hopefully, is a characterization of that dichotomy between the real economy and the financial economy, is long-cycle activity in mergers and acquisitions, private equity, and, to a point, venture capital. But really M&A and PE. Because, again, Chris, you know, I kind of go back to this and say, okay, look, when most of these corporations are involved in some type of M&A, they aren't just issuing new stock. In fact, in an environment like this, Chris, I would be issuing as little new stock as I possibly could in an M&A deal and borrowing as much money as I possibly could at near zero interest rates. Same deal on the private equity side here. You know, in quote-unquote, Chris, and I don't mean this in, you know, some monumental way, but the M&A community, the VC community, the PE community, they've really been characterized over time, rightly or wrongly, as the smart money. Oh, you know, these guys and girls really know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. Here. That's where the, you know, the hot shots are. Okay, great. We're seeing M&A activity and private equity activity today, Chris, as subdued as anything we've seen at the lows of the last 10 years.
Really?
And this is in nominal dollar M&A volume as well as PE volume and also on a per deal basis. So again, these folks have been treated to a once-in-a-lifetime low in debt financing costs. We should be seeing an M&A boom. We should be seeing a private equity activity extravaganza at these kind of numbers. I mean, the arbitrage between cost of debt capital and theoretical rate of return in the real economy should be absolutely huge. Why aren't we seeing this? Why aren't we seeing the quote-unquote smart boys and girls putting money to work like there's simply no tomorrow? And, Chris, the only answer I can come up with is they don't see rate of return in the real economy. We're seeing rate of return in the stock market. We're seeing rate of return in financial assets. But we should be seeing boom times in M&A and PE if we were in a healthy economic, an economic environment that looked like prior cycles. I don't mean to say it's unhealthy. We are getting growth. It's just small growth. But, again, if the economic outlook ahead was very, very bright, Chris, we'd be seeing M&A deals every 5 minutes, and we're seeing none of that.
Well, that's really fascinating. I just recently read that private equity was going to return a record amount to investors, but the Wall Street Journal didn't cover the other side of that, which is why are they returning so much? And I guess the answer is because they're not plowing it back into new deals quite as much. I'll have to look into that. Very interesting. So here we are. We're starting 2014. I know a lot of people, I mentioned before, some who are writing and saying they've sat on the sidelines around housing. They're wondering what to do. Other people have sat on the sidelines with respect to the equity markets, and many are starting to feel a little foolish for having stepped aside. Let's talk about, is this, what does somebody do going forward from here? Is this, let's start with housing. Is this a time to buy for somebody? Tough question. I know a lot of variables, but generally speaking, would you be patient here, or would you think we're in a new structural, this is the way the world works kind of moment?
Boy, and Chris, I'll tell you honestly, I'm guessing, you know, more than not. And I know both you and I, just as a little context and a little background here, both you and I sold our homes in the last decade, and we rented for a number of years, and then we bought homes back. And I think it was really because of the silliness that we were seeing in, the mortgage credit markets at that time. So, Chris, again, I'm going to give you a really bad answer here. I think it depends, number one, on the individuals, where they are in life and what their financial circumstances look like in life. And to me, and again, this is just me at a very basic level, Chris, to be able to lock in the cost of long-term housing, you know, at some either interest rate level and or you put up an amount of your cash out of your net worth, all you are doing is locking in a cost. And that's that. You know, I personally would not be, and I do this with clients all the time, you know, when we're looking at their finances. Do not count your house as one of your assets unless you're going to monetize that thing.
Uh-huh.
And for most people, they're not. So if it works for them in terms of their own specific set of circumstances, by all means. But what they're doing is not making a huge investment. They are locking in and hopefully freezing what would be a future cost. And we all know that, you know, real estate appreciates over time and that we're going to have to put money into it to maintain it. So that needs to be factored into it, too. The individual geographic areas, Chris, and again, just my stomach acid speaking more than not, for the bulk of the country, real estate prices have not done what they've done in New York. They have not done what they've done in the San Francisco Bay Area. And yes, some of the lower end here has been influenced by the institutional money, but I think on a kind of a rate of change basis, that upward price pressure being driven by the institutions is now starting to fade a little bit because rate of return is not what it was in the last 2 to 3 years. So that segment of the market is starting to look a little bit better, or let's say, you know, more appetizing from the standpoint that, you know, prices aren't going to the moon. But in some of these geographic areas that have been attracting capital, you know, like the New Yorks and the San Franciscos, things are very expensive. Again, Chris, I wish I knew, you know, what kind of lays ahead here. The only other issue that we're going to have to deal with, I think, in the housing market is once the investment demand is satiated, then what? Do we have a group of younger demographic that can come up that's getting better jobs, getting better wages, and able to buy homes? Well, Chris, right now, we're not seeing that. You know, we're not seeing, you know, very significant job growth for, let's call it, the 16 to 28-year-old section of life. And we're not seeing the wage growth at these levels either. So, again, I'm sorry. I know I kind of spun you in circles here and didn't give you a good answer, but I think individuals need to look at their geographic areas. They need to look at their own financial circumstances and kind of answer that question based on themselves, you know, as opposed to maybe the market as a whole.
Well, I certainly answer that question for myself non-economically, you know, just having to factor out the idea, am I going to make or lose money on a house? Because I think it's very wise to tell somebody, when we look at your net worth, we're going to strip the house that you live in out of that, because that's not part of the equation. For me, the decision rested on time variables. I wanted to own my own place so I could make certain improvements that take a lot of time and investment of money as well as time. So for me, it was that sort of a decision. I would say to somebody who's in one of those hotter markets that my personal advice would be, it might not hurt just to sit a little bit and watch. I've seen the rollover in housing markets follow a fairly predictable pattern. And the first thing you see is sort of a slumping in activity. Maybe the mortgage purchase apps are beginning of that, at least on the, let's say, non-cash institutional buy side, regular folks. And then you see inventory start to build and then prices roll. And then eventually everybody says, we had a bubble again, and we're going to have to go through some downturn. I'm not sure yet, but I'm seeing some early signs that say, little caution. If you can wait, maybe you wait. On the equity side, you said this is a TINA market. What do you mean by that?
Chris, you know, in one sense, as we look at, and last year was a poster child for this. You know, if you were in bonds, you lost money. If you were in gold, you lost money, you know, for the first time in many, many years in that bull market.
Yep.
If you were in emerging markets, you lost money.
Yep.
If you were in so many different, you know, Chris, one of the things I've even told the clients, 2013 was one of the worst years for diversified portfolios I've seen in many, many, many years, maybe decades, you know, more than not. So, you know, I think what we're seeing is a narrowing of asset classes and a narrowing of capital's decision making, if you will, to just what the Fed wanted, you know, equities and real estate, so to speak, for large diversified portfolios, they had one heck of a really tough year. So what we've been hearing in the TINA characterization is that there is no other alternative except stocks. Okay. Again, Chris, I'm speaking for myself solely. In an absolute sense, that's not a good enough investment rationale for me. You know, somebody said, hey, look, you have no alternative except to jump off the building here. Everybody else is doing it. You know, just jump. You know, that's not a good enough rationale. No way. But for capital that is forced to get rate of return, and Chris may be one of the poster children for this at the current time, is the pension industry, the pension funds. I mean, not only, you know, are they coughing up blood, meaning they're very, very underfunded, but in large, well-diversified portfolios, they're not earning the assumed rate of returns that they need to earn. So increasingly, and again, maybe this is just a little anecdotal example, the largest pension fund on planet Earth happens to be the Japanese pension fund. And if I'm not incorrect, it's about $1.2 trillion in equivalent, monies. 80% of that darn fund was holding Japanese government bonds, yielding what? 59 basis points?
Mm-hmm.
That just isn't going to do it, especially when implied inflation rates and real inflation rates in Japan are going straight up right now, especially for energy, food, and things like that.
Right.
So about 3 months ago, these guys hired five domestic Japanese equity managers, and they hired five U.S. equity managers, and they're going to start to reallocate money toward equities. Now, again, this is after the Nikkei had its greatest year since I don't know when, and this is after, you know, some of the other broader global markets, the equity markets, have gone up. But, Chris, they're being forced into this for survival. You know, they know they can't get rate of return anywhere else. So, in one sense, and again, this isn't sour grapes, and I'm not trying to say this is all the Fed's fault, and see what you get for doing QE, but in one sense, see what you get for doing QE.
Mm-hmm.
You pushed rates of return down to zero in very safe securities. The minute the Fed started talking about tapering, I mean, in one sense, Chris, if we roll the clock back to 2009, when the Fed started their QE extravaganza, that money absolutely got into U.S. equities and got into U.S. bonds. But as the money kept being printed, it rolled across planet Earth. It got into the emerging markets. It got into their bonds, their currencies, their equities. It got into global real estate. It got into gold. It got into commodities. The minute the T word was starting to be used by the Fed, all of a sudden, global investors were anticipating the rescission of that tidal wave of liquidity, and all of a sudden these asset classes started to contract to the point where it's really U.S. equities, the very large blue-chip global equities here, that continue to perform well. They offer yields higher than safe bonds, as we know, for now, and also, you know, again, the only place we're seeing rate of return. But, Chris, within this, we're crowding. We're herding. We're herding capital into a very, very small, you know, sector of asset classes. And then, you know, lastly, fortunately or unfortunately, when we have the global central bankers and the global politicians doing what they're doing, Europe, we may take 10% of your assets in the European banking system. Europe, we may invoke negative interest rates. You know, you bring a dollar into a bank, we'll give you back 99.5 cents.
Mm-hmm.
You cause capital to move. And potentially, Chris, to me this is a big issue. I think 2013 was driven as much by momentum and there's no place else to go and all those other wonderful things as it was driven by the weight and movement of global capital. Global capital coming out of China because it was scared of, if you will, if we're going to crack down on corruption and you've got corrupt capital, you get it out right away.
Mm-hmm.
Japan, the drop in the yen. You've got to move some of your capital to an alternative venue in an alternative currency. Europe, the threat of confiscation. And maybe just the basic question, Chris, of what the heck is the euro going to look like in 3 years?
Mm-hmm.
I know if my net worth was caught up in euros, I sure as heck would not be 100% invested in the euro. So a lot of this, Chris, I think, too, is global capital is hiding in an asset class that it considers to be relatively safe, because all these other asset classes have proven to be unsafe. And in one sense, you know, for right or for wrong, in U.S. and really large blue-chip globals, they've been very, very good stewards of capital over time. Their balance sheets are relatively clean. And if you're looking for safety, and this is just a very simple question, would you rather lever your family's balance sheet to one of the global governments, or would you rather lever it to Johnson & Johnson? Which one do you trust more? Which one's going to take better care of your capital over time? So, you know, Chris, I think there's so many different factors that have kind of been forcing capital into these narrow asset classes that basically are equities and real estate. The key issue to me going forward, and I'm sorry to go on and on about this, is risk management.
Mm-hmm.
For people who've sat this one out, for people mm-hmm. who've said, hey, wait a minute, I'm looking at the Bob Shiller Cape ratio here, and we're at levels that we've only seen four times in the last 100 years.
Right.
You know, you got to be kidding me. I'm not getting into this thing. The only way to participate in these markets, in my mind, is to make sure that you have a plan for managing risk, period. This is not throw your money into the equity market and hope for a great 2014, because every year that the market was up like it was last year was followed by a year that was up, you know, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't matter. It's about making sure that we manage risk, and we need to draw hard lines, you know, underneath certain levels of capital. Very easy to say, but in one sense, Chris, for your listeners too, I think this comes down, again, to individual families and making an assessment of how much risk they can afford to take. Below that line, they do not allow it to happen. I know it's a very trite comment to say, oh, you know, you have every day of your life to get back into the market, but sometimes you don't have a second chance to get out. The key issue is managing risk to be heavily involved in these markets at the moment.
You know, the old maxim is don't fight the Fed, and the Fed's been very clear that their interest is seeing the equity markets go up, so in many ways it's just siding with the Fed. But when it comes to the emerging market and the rest of the world, the Fed has sort of been more in the, I guess, the vein of Marie Antoinette. They've said to the rest of the world, let them eat cake, right? So Brazil can't print like we're printing, and I'm sure Argentina is heavily, very envious of our ability to monetize 40-50% of our federal debt. I'm sure Mexico is as well. I'm sure Greece would be very, very happy with that ability at this moment in time. But we've afforded ourselves that one. Well, Japan's got the same sort of privilege as well. But we've afforded ourselves that exorbitant privilege, and it's been fantastic. The question really is, how long can it go on? Do you see, you know, I've heard some people, I had arguments with people who said the Fed balance sheet could never get to $3 or $4 trillion, and here we are. Could it go to $40 trillion?
Boy, you know, Chris, at this point, I guess anything goes. If you'd have told me that we'd be in this set of circumstances today 10 years ago, I would have told you were out of your mind. And here we are. You know, so we've crossed so many imaginary boundaries, it isn't funny. But you know what? If you don't mind, I'm going to come at that from a little bit of a different way in terms of how far can this really go? Okay, I may sound like a raving nutball, or more than a raving nutball than ever, Chris, but here it comes. If we look at what's been going on really from a much, much, much broader lens, and we look at it over a multi-decade time period, and again, this is kind of me, and it's a little bit of the Austrian economics theme more than not, that we have been living in a, let's call it, multi-stage credit cycle.
Mm-hmm.
If we go back and look, this is the 1960s, this is the 1970s, we're at the very, very beginning of the acceleration in household credit that really went to blow-off proportions mm-hmm. in the middle part of the last decade. Okay, fine. The U.S. financial sector and the U.S. corporate sector in the United States also levered up, and they levered up over a multi-decade time period. The financial sector ultimately blows up. The household sector ultimately hits its comeuppance with residential real estate and way too much leverage. Okay, since 06, 07, 08, the key provocateurs of the continuation of the credit cycle have really been governments. And the U.S. government has done this in spades, but so have really global governments. Okay, but Chris, I think the box they're in is this one. When you double U.S. debt from 2008 until now, but the Fed artificially suppresses interest rates, and you can borrow in one-year treasuries at one-tenth of a basis point, you can't even feel it.
Mm-hmm.
You can go on taking all the debt you want until the capital market tells you it's over.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Right now in the United States, and every one of your listeners can do this, every single month the Treasury reports all U.S. government debt outstanding on their website, and they give you an average cost of capital for the United States. In the last couple of months, some of the numbers we were looking at are as follows. The interest-only cost on total U.S. debt right now is about $350 billion.
Mm-hmm.
For every 1% increase in interest rates, we're going to tack on another $170 billion. So it doesn't take too long, you know, in terms of interest rates. Call it 300 basis points on the upside, and you're pushing, what, $800, $900 billion a year in interest-only costs, maybe $1 trillion a year in interest-only costs. So, you know, Chris, I tell you, this is what I think the real issue is how can the Fed get out of this, because they know they're distorting the capital markets, yet not cause a huge increase in cost of capital for the U.S. government. And really, this is an issue, again, for global governments. I mean, you know, call up Kyle Bass and he'll talk to you about Japan for the next 5 hours and tell you what's, you know, what he thinks. But conceptually, it's the same kind of a deal. They cannot allow cost of capital to go up because all of a sudden the interest costs for the governments mushroom. And what is the capital market going to do when it sees that? And, okay, as a final comment here, and I am not saying the U.S. is Greece, okay? Far from it. But conceptually, it's not too far away. Everybody and their brother knew that Greece was living beyond its means. Everybody and their brother knew that they were digging a hole that they probably couldn't get themselves out of. Well, one day we woke up, and it mattered to the capital market.
Right.
And all of a sudden, 2% interest rates went 4, 4 went to 6, 6 went to 8, and all of a sudden, no one would lend them any money anymore except the European Central Bank. Okay, fine. Are we going to hit that type of a moment in the major developed economies like the Japans, like the U.S.'s, et cetera? And in one sense, I'm just asking myself, Chris, here we are back in May at the all-time lows of $1.45 on the 10-year Treasury, and we were over 3% at the end of the year. Is this the very beginning of global capital starting to question the balance sheet veracity and the ability of the large global governments to repay their debt? And maybe this is a little bit punctuated by the fact that we just need to remember, over the last 6 months, 9 months, the Fed hasn't been printing $85 billion a month buying stocks. They're buying bonds.
Mm-hmm.
And yet the 10-year Treasury yield has doubled. Ultimately, the free markets are bigger than the central banks. And I know, Chris, this may sound crazy, and a lot of people have said this already. We're just not there yet. The capital markets are bigger. And ultimately, in the long run, the capital markets, the global capital markets, are going to control and set rates. Are we at the very beginning of that change right now, with the inability, you know, of the 10-year Treasury to come back down and yield? Is this the very, very beginning? And, okay, one more crazy comment where, you know, I blow all credibility, I promise you, is the final act of the multi-decade credit cycle the deleveraging of global government balance sheets? Chris, I'll tell you, I think that's exactly how it ends, because the capital markets will force it. And the further the Fed goes, potentially the more violent the forcing it may be. And I think they realize this. So in one sense, I think what they'd love to do is tiptoe away from QE. They've convinced themselves that all they need to do is wordsmithing about how they won't raise short rates and tapering is not tightening.
Yeah.
Well, come on. When you were printing money, you told us it was loosening because it was the equivalent of negative interest rates. But now tapering's not tightening? In the end, Chris, the capital markets aren't stupid. They just aren't. And that's what I'm really looking for, is will the capital markets lose trust in the central bankers? Forget the stock market, you know, for a minute, because you know this. The bond market is for dough, but the equity market's for show. And I guess what I mean by that is the credit markets are all about the numbers. The equity markets are about greed. They're about emotion. A lot of different things drive them than just the numbers. So it's really the credit markets, Chris, where I think our focus really needs to be, because that's what's going to call the tune on not only the central bankers, but ultimately the global governments and their ability to continue levering up their balance sheets.
Well, I'm certainly keeping my eye firmly on the 10-year rate, which has been poking at the 3% level there and a little battle going on, but I'm convinced that that's doing it despite the Fed's best intentions and efforts at this point. So that's really where my attention is going to be focused for a while, because I agree this will happen in the capital markets. And I do have a bit of the Austrian economist in myself as well. I believe there's one quote I actually have taped over my desk by Ludwig von Mises that goes along the lines of when you have a credit expansion, you have only two options. You either voluntarily abandon it or you face a collapse of the currency system involved. That's the risk that I see us really facing. And when you talked about controlling risk, I believe there's some micro risks within portfolios. There's some macro risks here, too. This has never been tried before. We've been talking about 4 or 5 decades of data, sometimes 7, 8 decades, sometimes more, and we can't find anything to guide us here. We just have to rest on the idea that if it was possible to print your way to prosperity, I'm reasonably confident the Romans would have worked it out, or somebody earlier. And otherwise, we have to have confidence and faith that the particular cast of characters that sit around the FOMC table and the equivalent in the ECB and Japanese Central Bank, that somehow they've managed to find a new way to permanently manufacture prosperity from a mahogany board table, pressing ones and zeros that send out off of a enter key on a keyboard. If you believe in all that, I guess smooth sailing should be a great 2014. Otherwise, there could be some bumps along the way.
Chris, I think you're exactly right here. And you know, again, 2013 was one fun year, right?
Mm-hmm.
You see those kinds of years in terms of rate of return, especially in the equity market, maybe what, two, three, four times if you're lucky over a career. Those things don't happen every day. But this grand experiment, you know, that we're living through here, I think you're exactly right. So far, the capital markets, and at least the equity market, has given the Fed the benefit of the doubt. But at some point in time here, you know, the party just doesn't last forever. And maybe it's even that mindset, Chris, of, well, they said they're going to print money, so we know stocks go up. They were going to print money, then stocks are going to go up. Well, I'm waiting for the, well, we're still printing, but stocks go down. Well, no, we said we're still going to print. It's okay. No, but stocks go down. And it's that divergence, you know, that we're ultimately looking for here. But first, you know, all the capital that either must play or is absolutely starved for rate of return gets forced into those asset classes first. Very, very maybe simplistic question, Chris. After that happens, who's the next buyer?
It's a great question. And, Brian, I'm very cognizant of the fact that I've already personally chewed up a big portion of your entire 2014 on a percentage basis. You've been very generous with your time, and I could keep this conversation going a lot longer. I really want to thank you for your insights here. It's absolutely, I think, the right way to go is to keep our eye on the macro trends, to really understand what is and is not different in this story. And there are very few voices out there running counter to the mainstream narrative, which wants us to believe that all is well and all is mended. But I think a quick peek under the rug tells us there's a few rotten floorboards down there. And thank you for helping us to see those in a really fun, entertaining, and enjoyable manner.
Chris, I can't thank you enough for allowing me to be part of this at the very beginning of the year. Like you, I could go on for hours with and again, I very much appreciate the conversation. My very, very best to your listeners for the year that lies right ahead of us.
Thank you, and thank you for that. And I hope we can do this again sometime.
Thank you.